I'd like to speak a little bit tonight about Rabbi Cook, the first Ashkenazic chief rabbi of Eretz Yisrael, and about his father-in-law, his first father-in-law, who was known as the Aderes. When I was growing up, my father had a big library of a lot of Svarim. He never had any Svarim by Rav Cook. And the only time I ever saw Rav Cook quoted was in the Anglo-Jewish newspapers by conservative rabbis, who would always quote something that Rav Cook had said, and they would develop a whole philosophical idea. So I didn't know anything about Rav Cook. I thought he was a philosopher. The first time I came to realize that he was a big Goyen was I was already married. We had a few children, and we visited Eretz Yisrael. And then I met Rabbi Moshe Tzvi Neria. He was the founder of all the various yeshivot Bnei Akiva, a whole network of yeshivas in Eretz Yisrael. And he was trying to encourage me to move to Eretz Yisrael. And then he was born in Europe, and he came to Eretz Yisrael as a teenager, and he learned the miracles of Rav, and he wrote quite a few svarim about Rav Cook. So before I left, the day that I was leaving to come back to America, I was there with my wife and children for the summer, for a whole summer. And we were there through Chol Moed Sukkos. We were there for 3 months. And then on Chol Moed Sukkos, we came back. We had a 90-day ticket. And when we came back to America, the day that I was about to come back, his son came, one of his sons came, and he gave me a matana from his father, one of the svarim that he wrote about Rav Cook that was called Moadei Hariyah, how Rav Cook observed the Yom Tovim. So I was reading the Sefer on the plane, and then when I got back to America, it was in the middle of Sukkos. I was reading section on Sukkos. Then I realized what a big Talmid Chacham he was. I never realized he was a Goyna, and he was very strong in Halacha and in Kabbalah and in Agoda and everything. And I remember at that time, I remember that once the OU had used to have the annual convention, used to have every 2 years they had a convention over the Thanksgiving weekend. So they had a convention south of Baltimore. So on the way back from the convention, they encouraged some of the people, encouraged me I should stop off in the Baltimore yeshiva and meet Rabbi Ruderman, which I did. And I remember that time Rabbi Ruderman was telling me he was close. He knew Rabbi Moshe Soloveitchik, he knew Rabbi Soloveitchik. And he was telling me that sometimes history cheats certain people of the fame and of the covet that they deserve. So he was talking about Rabbi Soloveitchik was cheated of the covet that he deserved. So I think Rabbi Cook in America didn't get at all the covet that he deserved. Rabbi Cook was born in Latvia. His father had learned in Volozhin, and his father had traditions from the Vilna Gaon. In Volozhin, everything was from the Vilna Gaon. His mother was from a Lubavitcher family, and her father was close to the Tzemach Tzedek. So he had traditions when he was growing up. He had traditions both from the Gro and from Chabad and from the Baal HaTanya. He learned by different gedolim when he was a teenager. And then he got engaged to the daughter. His first wife was the daughter of the Aderes. We'll speak about him later. And after he got engaged to the daughter of the Aderes, then he went to learn in Volozhin for a year. At that time, both Rav Chaim and the Netziv were giving shiurim. I think the Netziv gave shiurim Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, and Rav Chaim gave the shiur Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, and Shabbos they would review. They would chazar everything. Their yeshiva was approximately a blat gemara, and they would learn from brochas to nida. They learned straight to all the gemaras. So some of the talmidim only attended Rav Chaim shir. They didn't go to the netzivs. Some only attended the netziv shir. They didn't go to Rav Chaim shir. My impression is that most of the talmidim attended both of the shirim, even though the shirim are so different from each other. So Rav Cook only attended the netziv shir. He didn't attend Rav Chaim's, and the netziv liked him very much. He was the only student in yeshiva who had permission from the netziv to sit and wear tefillin all day long in the Beis Medrash. At prime, they say, was not so happy about that, but the netziv was his wife's grandfather, so he couldn't argue with him. So Rav Cook later considered the netziv his Rebbe Mubak, even though he learned by other gedolim, he considered the netziv his main Rebbe. After he got married, he served in Rabbanus in two different communities in Europe, in Zeimelin and another community, and in Boisky. And later on, he moved to Eretz Yisrael. They say that they asked him, different people asked him, what got him so hooked on Zionism? Why did he get so excited? What happened that he was so excited about living in Eretz Yisrael? So he used to answer, when you learn Chumash, from the time that HaKadosh Baruch Hu tells Avraham Avinu, Lech Lecha Me'artzecha, the whole thrust of all the Chumash, from the beginning to the end, is that we're all supposed to live in Eretz Yisrael. And that's mainly what he's known for. He was a great goyin in halacha and kabbalah and agoda and everything, but mainly he's known for the fact that he felt that because the Jews were in Golus so many years, so we weren't creative, we weren't being mechadish in the right direction, and that we have to come back to Eretz Yisrael now and try to be mechadish all over again. His main idea that he's known for is about Eretz Yisrael. He was so beloved by the Netziv. On one occasion, after he was married already, he came back to visit the yeshiva. He came to visit in the 9 days, and the Netziv was so excited to see him. So he said, it's a sudas mitzvah to be mekabel p'nei Talmid Chacham. This was a Talmud of his. And he said he's going to have fleishiks in the 9 days. It's enough of a sudas mitzvah, because the Talmid Chacham came to visit him, that he's allowed to have fleish. Later on, there's an incident with Rav Kook that could be that is based on this issue. Rav Kook moved to Eretz Yisrael in 1904, and he took over the Rabbanus in Yafo. The one before him was a big Talmid Chacham. I forgot his name. He's the one who put out the Siddur HaGro. He was big Talmid Chacham. He was strong in Kabbalah also, and he was the one who supervised the Het HaMechira. In Eretz Yisrael, the people who the original group who moved to Eretz Yisrael to Maskeret Batya, that was a religious group of 11, of Shmuel Mulliver, lived in Europe, and he visited Baron Rothschild, and he convinced him that he should sponsor 10 religious Balabatim who are going to move to Eretz Yisrael and make a religious yeshuv. Baron Rothschild sent, he agreed that he's going to pay for that, he's going to sponsor the whole thing. And then when they went to the train station, there were 11 families. So the Shaliach of Baron Rothschild said, how come there are 11? The Baron only agreed to 10. So they said they want to make sure they have a minyan every day. So if someone's going to have a cold, someone's going to be sick, so they won't have a minyan. So they decided they have to have 11. So the representative of the Baron thought that that was a good explanation. So he paid for all 11. So this group moved to Eretz Yisrael, and every day they would daven and they would learn, and then they had a farm and they would be working on the farm. So they came originally from Lithuania, and they used to correspond. They used to send mail. They didn't have any telephone. They used to send mail to one of the big rabbanim. Rav Mordechai Gimpel Yaffe was their poisek back in Europe. So the chaylus on Hilchas Treifas, Hilchas Taras HaMishpacha, they asked to the Badats in Yerushalayim. But the long-term shaylus, they were still in touch with the Rabbanim in Europe. And then the Rabbanim in Europe were working on a Het HaMechira for them, for Shemitah. But because they were asking all of the immediate shaylus, they were asking to the Badats. So the Badats told them, in another 2-3 years, it's going to be Shemitah. They shouldn't rely on any Heterim. They have to observe Shemitah. So even though the Rabbanim in Europe worked out this whole Het HaMechira, they didn't go for it, because the Badats told them not to rely on any kulas, they should observe Shemitah. So the Baron was very upset. He was paying money to send a doctor every week to this Moshav Maskeret Batya. His name Maskeret Batya, named after Baron Rothschild's mother. His mother's name was Beatrice, and her Yiddish name was Batya, and he visited the Moshav, and he saw that they're religious, and they daven every day, and they learn every day. Nice people. So he gave them permission to use his mother's name in the name of the Moshav. Unfortunately, now it's not even a Shem Shabbos Moshav, but at that time, that was a religious Moshav. So the Baron was upset why they didn't use the Heter Mechira. So he refused to pay for the doctor to come every week, and some of the children died because they didn't have a doctor visiting all the time. Some of the animals died also. The animals dying means that they won't be able to do work on the farm, no parnasa. So they told over what happened to the Rabbanim from the Badat, so they realized that it was a mistake, that they should have relied on the Heter Mechira. So they told him that another 7 years, when Shemitah comes again, they better rely on the Heter Mechira, but they don't want to touch it. They should go to the rabbi in Yafo. He'll do the Mechira to the Nochri of the farm for them. So which they did the next time. So this, the rabbi in Yafo was a big Talmud Chacham. He's the one who used to take care of the Heter Mechira. So when he passed away, that was part of the job description. They're looking for a new rabbi to be the rabbi in Yafo and all the Moshavot, all the farms near Yafo. And part of the job description is that he has to take care of the Heter Mechira. Like whoever becomes the rabbi in the Jewish center is supposed to supervise the Manhattan Erev. Whoever is the rabbi in the Young Israel of Flatbush has to supervise the Flatbush Erev. Because the original Erev was made by the rabbi in the Jewish center. The original Erev of Flatbush was made by the rabbi who was then in the Young Israel of Flatbush. So that was part of the job description. Rav Kook was not too thrilled about the Heter Mechira. In fact, he died in 1935, Gimel Elul, his yahrzeit, and he was sick for quite a while. I think he died from cancer, and he was sick for quite a while, and he suffered a lot. And on his deathbed, a few months before he died, he mentioned to people, it could be that he's suffering because of the Heter Mechira. He always encouraged people to observe Shemitah, but he said for those who feel they're just not able to, so he was taking care of the Heter Mechira for them. So Rav Kook originally was the Rav in Yafo, and he was never a member. He never joined the Mizrahi. It was a matter of policy. I don't know exactly what the Mizrahi was like at that time, but he felt it's not for him. He always belonged to Aguda, and he was appointed a member of the Vad Matas Gedolei HaTorah, and he was till the day that he died. He felt he was a member of the Vad Matas Gedolei HaTorah. So 1914, right before the First World War broke out, the Agudas Yisrael was sponsoring a Knesset HaGedolah, an international convention in Switzerland. So he already lived in Eretz Yisrael. He was a rabbi in Yafo since 1904. So he 10 years after 1914, he traveled to Chutz Lortz in order to participate in the international convention of the Agudas Yisrael. So that's when the that's when the First World War broke out, and he got stuck, and he couldn't come back to Eretz Yisrael. He couldn't go anywhere. So at that time, he was stuck in Switzerland for quite a while, and then he was invited to become the rabbi in a very big shul in London, which he agreed to take the position on the condition that as soon as he would be able to leave, as soon as the way back to Eretz Yisrael would be clear, he would leave. He didn't agree to become the rabbi in the big shul in London for a long period of time, only till he would be able to get back to Eretz Yisrael. When he was there they say that the Chafetz Chaim commented, I think I saw this in Pin, the Chafetz Chaim commented that he doesn't think the Netziv had two sons. He had his oldest son was from the first wife, that was a Chaim Berlin, and the second son was from the second wife. Rameh Bar Ilan. So Rameh Bar Ilan was one of the leaders of the Mizrahi. So they say that the Chafetz Chaim said, apparently Rameh Bar Ilan didn't really know his father too well, because if he would have really understood his father, he would never have joined the Mizrahi. I don't know. So that's what the Rav Kook also, on principle, he never joined the Mizrahi, he always belonged to the Aguda. They say, the story goes that when Rav Kook was in Switzerland there, on his way, I think, to this Knesset HaGedolah, he had to stay off in an inn to sleep overnight. And he was davening Shacharis the next morning, and he was saying Korbanos. Before he got to Baruch Shem, he was saying the Korbanos. And in the adjacent room, the Nazir had rented a room in the same motel. The Nazir of David HaKohen, the Nazir had learned in Volozhin. And he was a learned fellow. He was religious, but he decided to go to university. Quite a few of the Talmidim who had learned in Volozhin went to university later on. Some of them went into physics, some of them went into banking, chemistry, whatever, different fields. So the Nazir went into philosophy and comparative religion. And then when he was in the room adjacent to Rav Kook in the same inn, he heard Rav Kook, that's how the story got, heard Rav Kook say the korbanos that he said before Baruch Shamar, and his heart melted away, and he decided no more university. He said he felt he needs a kapara for going to university and studying philosophy, comparative religion. He's going to become a Talmud of this big tzaddik in the next room. And he did. He became a Talmud of his for the rest of his life. And he was Mekabel Naziris as a kapara for having gone to university and taking courses on philosophy and comparative religion. I remember the first time I visited Eretz Yisrael, we were married, we didn't have any children yet, so we visited Eretz Yisrael to be blessed with children. The Gemara says sometimes because they live in Chutz La'aretz, that's why you don't have children. So we brought quite a few $1,000s for Rab David Soloveitchik, and we bought for Beryl Soloveitchik also. So when we went to the address, Rab David Soloveitchik lived, and we were looking by the mailbox which apartment he lives in. So we realized that the Nazir lived in the same apartment building. So after we visited Rav David Soloveitchik, we gave him the money. We spent a little time by him. Then we knocked on the door by the Nazir. So the Nazir had a yarmulke on top of his head, and he had all the hair. In between the yarmulke and the head, it was a couple of inches high. The yarmulke was a few inches above his head, because a Nazir can only take a haircut when the Naziris is over and he brings the Karbonis. So if you live, his manchein beis hamigdash kaim. So the Nazir is stuck for the rest of his life. I remember on that occasion, the Nazir was carrying on a whole conversation with us. So he was talking to us, among other things. He said over at Dvar Torah, the name of Rav Kook, that the Gemara has a line that everybody knows the line, they don't know where it comes from. The Gemara in Bava Basra has a line, Avira d'Eretz Yisrael Machkim, that the air of Eretz Yisrael makes you smarter. So we usually assume, all the Rishonim assume, that the Talmid HaChachamim in Eretz Yisrael are much greater than those Talmid HaChachamim who lived in Bavel. So he asks my wife, does she study Gemara? So she says, no. So he says, does she know where it says in the Gemara, Avira d'Eretz Yisrael Machkim? So I said, I don't remember where it says. How is she supposed to know? He says to me, he doesn't, in Hebrew, he says, he doesn't believe that I don't know where. He's only asking my wife whether she remembers where it says. So we said, both of us don't know. So he said, the Gemara has it in the end of Bava Basra, the Mishnah has Misha Meis. The Mishnah has a din if you don't know who died first. If one person, the two people are related, one person dies first, the Yerusha goes in one direction. The other person died first, so the Yerusha goes, they both died. But you don't know who died first, so the Yerusha goes in a different direction. So how do you paskin in such a case? Whoever is muhsa keeps the mamhu is considered muhsa. So the Mishnah has a lot of details about that. After the Second World War, there are a lot of dinei Torah, because the Nazis killed a lot of Jews, and a lot of times it wasn't known who was killed first. So you have a lot of Mishnayos. There's nothing to tilpel about. All the dinim are spelled out in the Mishnayos and the Gemara and Shulchan Aruch. So there's one din that's a little unclear in the Mishnah. If you don't know who died first, so the Mishnah says, Anachasim b'cheskasim. So b'cheskasmi. So the Gemara has a machlekes. So one of the Chachamim, when he lived in Bavel, he understood Mishnah in one way. Then when he moved to Eretz Yisrael, Avir Eretz Yisrael Machkim, so he understood the Mishnah differently. So he gave the correct shot. So he said, when he came to Eretz Yisrael, he came to the realization that there was a concept of Huchsa Nachla Osa Hashavit. Until he came to Eretz Yisrael, it never occurred to him that this is Nachlas Reuven, this is Nachlas Shimon, this is Nachlas Yehuda. Every Shevet had its own area. So there may be such a concept as there's a muchzakus to the Shevet. Until he moved to Eretz Yisrael, he just knew that there's a concept of muchzak, a private person is a muchzak. But then when he came to Eretz Yisrael and he toured the land and they showed him, this is Nachlas Shimon, this is Nachlas Reuven, this is Nachlas God, then he realized maybe there's a concept of huchzak nachla b'osa Hashevet. So he said, Rav Kook said, we don't say Avir Eretz on Machkem and everything, on all our Bechelkos Shulchan Aruch. You only say it in this one area. When would have thought Rav Kook would not say like that. So that's what he told me. The Rav Kook interpreted that Gemara like that. So so Rav Kook, for a while, for a few years, 2 or 3 years, he was the rabbi in this shul. in London. It's interesting. He was very close before he went to this, can I see Agdalen, before he got stuck there when the First World War broke out. He was very close to Rabbi Anke Moshe Chalap, Rabbi Zvulun Chalap's grandfather. Rabbi Moshe Chalap was brought up in the Yeshiva Yoshan, and Rabbi Yosef Chaim Zonnefeld was the rabbi there. They all looked up to him. And when he met Rav Kook, he fell in love with Rav Kook, and that was his Rebbe. And he writes in some of the printed letters that they have from him. You know, on one occasion, he attended a bris, and his Marena Rabbeinu Godel Hador was there, Rav Kook Godel Hador, and Rabbi Zonnefeld was also there. He doesn't write at all. He was brought up by Rav Zonnefeld in that community. He doesn't write at all. The same degree of kavod to Rav Yosef Chaim Zonnefeld as writes. It's interesting. Rav Zonnefeld was always respectful of Rav Kook, but the followers of Rav Zonnefeld used to always attack Rav Kook. They used to call him an apikoros, and they were right of him. So it's interesting. Rav Moshe Tzvi Neria named one of his sons after Rav Kook, Avram Yitzchok. So that son died young from a brain tumor. I remember when he came to America. He had surgery in New York City, and then with the bandages on his head, I went to visit him in the hospital, and then I invited him to give a shir in the kollel. So he came, and he said, a chabur, it's very nice. Then we wrote it up when we printed it in the Beis Yitzchak at that time. And then, unfortunately, a year later, he died from that brain tumor. So during his lifetime, he's always trying to find out more about Rav Kook. They always wanted to know, why did they call him an apikoros? What did he do? What did he say? What did he do? He was Makarev, the anti-religious Jews. He felt you don't have to be right for all the Chilonim, all the anti-religious. You have to be Makarev everybody. So that's one of the reasons why they called him an apikoros. But the son of Rav Neria, Avram Yitzchok Neria, always wanted to hear more stories about Rav Kook. He was named after him. So on one occasion, someone told him the following story. I think it was, who was the tzaddik in Yerushalayim? Who? Rabbi Levine. So I think he says Rabbi Levine told him this story, and his father in Rav Neria lived in a different city from the son. So the son sent the father a letter, and then he printed this letter later after the son passed away. So he wrote in the letter, I think Rabbi Levine told him, that when Rav, during that year, that Rav Kook learned in Voloshin, he was very close to the Netziv. So they had, that was the end of the period of Voloshin. Voloshin was closed around 1892. And at that time, they had all kinds of maskilim who were attending the yeshiva. They wanted really to go to university to have some intellectual excitement, but there was so much anti-Semitism, they wouldn't accept them in any university. So the only second best place for intellectual excitement was a yeshiva. So Bialik was then, he was not, he was a secular person. Bialik was a student in Voloshin. He wrote about the yeshiva, he wrote about the Beis HaMedrash, and others as well. So one of the students in the yeshiva was an apikoros. So Rav Kook was very close with the Netziv. So he told the Netziv, one of the students an apikoros, and they should really drop him from the yeshiva. So the Netziv dropped the student. So a year later, Rav Kook felt bad. Why did I tell the Netziv to drop the student? I should have recommended they should work with the student to try to be makar of him, to straighten them out. So later on, he attributed the fact that they attacked him as an apikoros to the fact that he mastered to the Netziv to kick out the apikoros from the yeshiva. Instead of encouraging him to kick him out, he should have really encouraged them to work with the Talmud to see if they can straighten him out. They tell the story about the Chafetz Chaim, that there was once a student in Radin who was caught smoking on Shabbos. So the Chafetz Chaim called him into, he didn't expel the student from the yeshiva, called him into his office, and he spoke to him for a while. And then the student walked out, and he had tears in his eyes, and he stayed in the yeshiva for a couple of months, and then he went to America. And no one knew what did the Chafetz Chaim tell him when they were in the room together. And what did he do after he went to America? So years later, Rabbi Shlomo Riskin was telling over this incident in public in Florida in a shul on Shabbos afternoon. He was saying, look, the Chofetz Chaim didn't expel a student just because he was Mechal Shabbos. He kept him on and he worked with him. And he said, we don't know what the conversation was. That was Shabbos afternoon. So Mitzvah Shabbos after Ma'ariv, one of the people in the shul came over to Rabbi Riskin and he wrote up the story later. And he told him, I was the student who was caught smoking on Shabbos. And the Chofetz Chaim just held my hands. And he just kept on saying, Shabbos, Shabbos, Shabbos. And he was crying and tears were falling from his eyes into my hands. And that was all. He just kept on saying, Shabbos, Shabbos. He didn't expel him. He kept him on in the yeshiva. And then this student later on left the yeshiva on his own, came to America. He was in the rabbinate for a few years. And then he retired. And now he lived in Florida. After he retired, he lived in Florida. A very interesting story. So that's what Rav Kook felt, that it wasn't right. Later he realized it wasn't right on his part.
His palm was wet.
Oh, yeah, and then he said that every Friday afternoon after that incident, he would feel as if his palms would be sweating. He felt as if he still has the tears of the Chofetz Chaim on his palm for years and years afterwards. He would feel his palm sweating every Friday afternoon to remind him that he shouldn't be Mechal Shabbos anymore. Anyway, so that's they used to attack Rav Kook a lot. In fact, there was a big an issue on one occasion. The Aguda had a Knesset Agdola, not the one in 1914 when this one was later. There was another Knesset Agdola when one of the speakers got up. Chofetz Chaim attended that Knesset Agdola. So one of the speakers got up and he was attacking Rav Kook and saying that he's an apikoros and this and that and the other thing. And when they told the Chofetz Chaim that they attacked Rav Kook, he said he's leaving the convention. He's not going to attend any more session. How can they attack Rav Kook? He respected him very much. He knew him when he was younger. He said, what, he became an apikoros in his old age? How can it be? In fact, someone in Eretz Yisrael just recently, about 5-10 years ago, published the Sefer with the correspondence between the Chofetz Chaim and Rav Kook. Very interesting, the way he was so respectful of him. So the Rav Kook, for many years, the Psak HaMekubal in Eretz Yisrael was, the accepted Psak was, like it says in Shulchan Aruch, like Rabbi Yosef Kara writes in his Tshuvas on Avkas Rechel, that in the days of Rabbi Yosef Kara in the 1500s, there were many Balabatim who would visit Eretz Yisrael from the neighboring countries, from the Arab countries. They would visit for Yom Tovim, for Shalosh Regalim. So it's a question whether you observe 1 day Yontif or 2 day Yontif, 2 days Yontif. So the Psak HaMekubal for many centuries was, like Rabbi Yosef Kara writes, the practice was during his lifetime, that the visitors from Chutz Lartz would observe 2 days Yontif. And the Chacham Tzvi, who never lived in Eretz Yisrael, the Chacham Tzvi lived in Europe all of his lifetime, and his son was Rabbi Yankev Emden also, so they felt they only observe 1 day. If you're in Eretz Yisrael, even if you're only a visitor and you plan to go back to Chutz Lartz, you only observe 1 day. So Rav Kook felt like that also. So whenever there would be tourists coming to Eretz Yisrael, he would always encourage them that they should only observe 1 day Yontif. And then they would tell him his daito lachzor. They plan to go back to Chutz Lartz, so he would tell them, you're a la bardas. They would say daito lachzor. He would say, you're a la bardas. You shouldn't go back. Many of them came from Germany. The wealthy people came to Eretz Yisrael for Pesach to stay in a kosher hotel. So he said, you're a la bardas, there's so much anti-Semitism. What are you going back to Germany? Some of them felt very insulted. How did Rav Kook call them a la bardas? Some of those people were later killed by the Nazis. And Rav Kook was warning them, they shouldn't go back. There's a famous story that when Rav Kook was ready, after the First World War, he went back to Eretz Yisrael in 1919, I think, after the war was over. And then they appointed him as the chief rabbi of all of Eretz Yisrael. And then 2 years later, I think 1921, he established the whole Rabbanut, the Rabbanus of Russia, the way we have it now. He arranged it in such a way that the conservatives and the reforms shouldn't have any leg to stand on. He wanted to protect Eretz Yisrael from the attacks of the conservative and the reform. So the Balabatim who had come for Pesach to stay in the hotels always needed a hechsher. on hotels. So one of the hotel owners came to Rav Kook, who was the chief rabbi at that time, and he asked him, can he give a hechsher on the hotel for Pesach? He said, do you plan to have a Seder the second night or not? So he said, yes. All the tourists who come want to have a Seder on the second night. He said, that's Keneged Hadin. You're only supposed to observe one day Yontif. I can't give a hechsher. So the hotel keeper said, what do you mean not going to give a hechsher? So I'm going to lose all of my business. People are going to come from Europe, going to see I have no hechsher, so they won't want to stay by my hotel. So he said, sorry, if you're going to have 2 days Yontif, it's Keneged Hadin, and he can't give a hechsher. So the hotel owner didn't know what to do. So he asked his friends, do they have any suggestions? So this is a famous story. So one of their friends said, Rav Kook has a yeshiva. America said, Rav Kook, go to the yeshiva, pick out a young man who's married, has a family, and needs a parnasa, and ask him if he'll be the mashgiach in your hotel. And he'll certainly offer him a significant amount of money, and he'll certainly agree because he needs a parnasa. And then after he'll agree, so then ask him, can he get the Rosh Yeshiva, Rabbi Kook, to give his endorsement of your hashgacha? He wanted to get, so Rav Kook is not going to turn him down because he needs, the young man needs the parnasa. So that's what he did. So the hotel owner went to American Sarav and he spoke to one of the young married Avrechim in the yeshiva. And he agreed to do the hashgacha work. And then he said, can you speak to Rav Kook? So he spoke to Rav Kook. Rav Kook realized what was going on. He went through the back door. He's going to get him to give the hashgacha. So he told, Rav Kook told the young man, yes, he'll give his endorsement of the hashgacha. But the reason why he didn't want to give was because Yantav Sheni, they're going to have a second Seder. So he's going to solve the problem. If they'll have an orchestra playing music the second night of Pesach, whoever wants to have a Seder can have a Seder, isn't it? But officially it's Chalamoy. Officially it's not Yontif. So if I have an orchestra playing the violin and playing music during the Seder, then it's okay. Then he can endorse the Hashgacha. That was the famous story. I remember on one occasion we were visiting Eretz Yisrael for Sukkos. So the second night of Sukkot, for all the Americans who were tourists, we were observing Yontav Sheni, and one of the Rabbanim from Mishal Avim came to celebrate with his students, Simchas Beis HaSheva. So he was playing the violin. We were observing Yontav Sheni, he was playing the violin. So it reminded me of this story about Rav Kook, that he'll only give the Hashgacha if they play music on the second night of Yontav. There's a famous incident of Rav Kook when he was already the chief rabbi. He used to give hechsherim to different factories where they process different kinds of food. So one of the factories wanted to make shemen kitnias. Ashkenazim have a meaning that we don't eat kitnias on Pesach. So the question is, you don't eat kitnias because if you're going to cook the kitnias in water, people may make a mistake and think just like you're allowed to cook kitnias, or they'll think you're allowed to cook wheat and barley also in water. You cook wheat in water, it's going to become chametz. So years ago, such a chumrah was introduced. And the many who are upset about the whole chumrah, the Sfarim never had the chumrah, and even the Ashkenazim, the many Ashkenazim are not so thrilled about this chumrah. So the shad is, what about shemen kitnias? What if you process the kitnias in such a way that you got oil out of it? So Rav Kook wrote a whole tshuva that shemen kitnias is not included in the gzeira, and he backed it up with many sources from the earlier poskim. So at that time, the badatz from the Eirach HaRedis, the Bezdin Tzedek of the Eirach HaRedis, came out against him, and that's the way it remained for many years. That they don't, not only instead of this minig being poiches v'hoilach, it keeps on getting bigger and bigger, and they keep on adding on more things to the list of kitnias. Like when I was young, when I was single, I remember everybody used to use planters peanut oil for Pesach, because peanuts is a question in the first place whether it's included in kitnias. And even if it is included in kitnias, it's a question whether shemen kitnias should be osur. So it really should be mutter for two reasons. And now, nobody eats peanuts on Pesach, nobody eats any peanut oil, and nobody gives a hechsher on the peanut oil. When I was growing up, everybody used planters peanut oil. I remember when I was in high school, one of the rabbis who had learned at Meir Yeshiva told us when he learned in Europe, when he lived in Europe, they never heard that there's anything wrong with eating peanuts on Pesach. The first time they heard it was when they were in the Beis Medrash in Shanghai. They had a Chinaman who used to wash the floor. He was the super in the building. And one of the boys was sitting and learning in the Beis Medrash, eating peanuts. So the Chinese super in the building said, "Hametz, hametz." So he said, "What hametz?" So he was pointing. So he said, "Where? What? What's hametz?" So Tilly finally touched the peanut. They looked at him like he was crazy. The first time they ever heard that there's any issue of eating peanuts on Pesach. But that somehow this chumrah not to eat the kidneys keeps on getting bigger and bigger, and they keep on including more. I mentioned earlier that when Rav Kook visited after he was married, and he came to visit the Netziv, and the 9 days, and the Netziv said it's a Sudas Mitzvah. So Rav Neria has many, many stories, all fascinating stories about Rav Kook. So he has one story. Rav Kook was busy taking care of something in the Bezin office, and the practice then was that everybody had fleshig. All the people went to work. In Tel Aviv, he used to have fleshigs for lunch, and there was no kosher restaurant for fleshigs, so they all ate nevela, they all ate non-kosher meat for lunch. So till after many years, the Mizrahi finally opened a restaurant, a kosher restaurant, where they had fleshigs. So it came the 9 days, so the shaila was, should they stay open? You're not supposed to have fleshigs in the 9 days, but if they're going to close, then the alternative is that people who would normally eat the kosher fleshy meal are going to eat the nevela meat, they'll go to the non-kosher restaurant. So what should they do for the 9 days? So they sent a representative from the restaurant to go ask Rav Kook. So Rav Kook is busy taking care of something else. And he saw this man is waiting and waiting for quite a while. So he excused himself from whatever the din Torah was. And he walked over and he asked, "What is it you're waiting? You want to speak to me?" So he told him, "Yeah, they have the shayla. They're allowed to stay open in the 9 days." So Rav Kook said, "Quickly, you can stay open and everybody can eat fleshiks, even the religious Jews." So how can it be? How can the religious Jews eat fleshiks? It's the 9 days. So he said, it's a Sudas Mitzvah. The fact that you're saving the other people from eating treifas, that's enough of a Sudas Mitzvah that everyone is allowed to eat fleshiks. So my impression was that he probably got this idea from the fact that the Netziv decided you're allowed to have fleshiks because the Talmid Chacham came to visit him. That's enough of a Sudas Mitzvah to permit the whole minig not to have fleshiks in the 9 days. It's only a minig, it's not a real din. So it's sufficient if you have a bit of a Sudas Mitzvah, it's enough to permit to eating fleshiks in the 9 days. They have also a lot of fascinating stories. I have another interesting story that on one occasion, Rav Kook, I think this was when he was still in Yafo, so he had to be Mesadar a get for a couple. And they had made up in advance who the sofer is going to be, who the Edom are going to be. One of the Edom didn't come. The sofer was there and the other Edom was there. And one of the Edom didn't show up. So they're waiting and waiting, waiting, waiting. So the secretary of the Besen was a religious Jew. So he said, if you want, I'll serve as the Edom. So Rav Kook said, not yet. We'll see. So they waited another 15 minutes, another 15 minutes, another 15 minutes. He kept on asking, if you want, I'll be the other Edom. So finally, Rav Kook had to tell him why he doesn't want him to be the Edom. So he says, people who work in an office often, without even thinking, will use an envelope from the office for their own purposes. So they'll use a stamp to send their own mail, and that's Geneva. So the din is that a ganef is posulatus. So strictly speaking, the Gemara says if a person ganfes from someone else in his Moira Heter, he thinks that there is not so terrible. He knows that it's wrong. Let's say people cheat on income tax. They know it's wrong. But they say, look, everybody cheats on income tax a little bit. So they're also cheating. So even though they're ganavim, but the Gemara says that's ganav nis and ganav tishrei. If a person gambles and he really has upset teretz, why it's not so bad, strictly speaking, is kosher. But he said he doesn't want to use secretaries to be an aide on a get, a rachasana, because he's afraid that the secretary every so often will use an envelope or a piece of paper or a stamp for his own purposes. There were a lot of Midas Chassidus from Rav Kook. He had a lot of Hanhogas. One of his Hanhogas was on Pesach night. The din is when you have a cup of wine for Kiddush or for Havdalah, you're supposed to rinse out the cup of wine inside and outside before you make Kiddush. So on Pesach night, we say we have arba kosos. So we wash out the Becha the first time. And then the second time, you have wine left over and you fill up the cup with more wine. So Rav Kook followed that opinion. The Kaf HaChaim quotes this opinion. that more correct is you should empty out the whole cup, either pour the wine into some other cup or drink all the wine, and then rinse out the cup before the second cup and before the third cup and before the fourth cup, even though it has your own germs. It doesn't have someone else's germs there, but still, each time you're about to recite the bracha lakos, so his practice would be, he would rinse out the whole cup beforehand. And a lot of personal midas chasidus. When Rav Kook was in London, I started to say before, he was, Rav Bianca Moshe Chalap was very close to him. Before he went to the first 10 years as an Eretz Yisrael, he became so enamored of Rav Kook. So when Rav Kook was stuck in London for a few years during the First World War, Rav Bianca Moshe Chalap would go to the Kosel HaMarovi and start thinking about Rav Kook, and Rav Kook would be thinking about him. They would communicate long distance, like mental telepathy, without talking on a telephone, without sending any letters. And later on, I think they published all of their conversations that they had just thinking about each other. I never heard of such a thing, but they wrote it all up. Rav Kook's tshuva, most of his tshuvas are very normal style of tshuvas, and they quote that the Chazon Ish used to encourage young avrechim who are learning Yerideya in order to get smicha, in order to become rabbanim. He used to encourage them that they should look in Rav Kook's tshuvas and they should learn from Rav Kook's style how to work on a psak halochem, how to figure out a psak halochem, because he had the traditional style of tshuvas. I remember when we were learning Shulchan Aruch HaRachayim in the yeshiva, so one of the students asked Rav Soloveitchik, which swarm should be used? What swarm should be looking? So one of the boys said that Rav Kook has tshuvas on Chelek HaRachayim, should be looking his sefer. Remember, Rav Soloveitchik said he's not familiar at all with Rav Kook's swarim. His swarim HaMachshava, a very difficult style Hebrew. So he said he doesn't really understand what he's driving at. He's not familiar with his tshuvas either. He said the only sefer Rav Kook's that he understands is the Siddur, the Oilos Riyah, and that he enjoyed very much, that he recommended to us. There was one particular comment that he used to quote in public every so often in his Rav Soloveitchik, in his drushes and Aseres Mei Tshuva. Rav Kook commented on the Nusach HaTfila that we recite, I think, to Ne'ila. We say, Elokai, what does that mean? Before I was born, it was Enikidai. What does it mean? So Rav Kook interprets, I was born, let's say, he was born 1863, something like that, 1865. So he says, in 1765, Enikidai. It wouldn't have been good for me to be brought into the world, because every person is brought into the world with a purpose, menashamayim, with a shlichas, he should try to accomplish something. So if he would be born 100 years before, 20 years before he's actually born, he wouldn't be able to accomplish it. Kadosh Baruch Hu brings Zemiran into the world at that time that he can accomplish something. The person says, I haven't accomplished my mission in life. So Rav Soloveitchik liked that interpretation. He used to say it over. In the name of the Netziv. When Rav Soloveitchik was a candidate for the Rabbanus in Tel Aviv, that was the one time that he visited Eretz Yisrael. That's when Rav Kook was on his deathbed. Rav Soloveitchik was there for Shavuos of 1935, and his wife gave birth to a baby girl when he was in Boston, and he was in Eretz Yisrael. And they didn't give the baby a name until he came back from Eretz Yisrael, because his mother wanted to name the baby after her mother, Gittel, Tova. And he said, how do you know the baby's going to be a good baby? He didn't like the name. So they had to wait till he came back there from Eretz Yisrael, and then his mother won anyway. So they named the baby Tova. So at that time, that's when Rav Kook was on his deathbed. Rav Kook died on Gimel Elul, 1935. So when he went to visit Rav Kook in the hospital on his deathbed, so when he learned in Balozhin, he respected very much the Netziv. He didn't go for Rav Chaim Soloveitchik style of shir. He went to the Netziv shir. So he said he sees in Rav Soloveitchik, it reminds him of the Netziv. And he encouraged his Talmidim, encouraged his son, Rav Tzvi Yehuda Kook, and encouraged the Talmidim that they should all go listen to Rav Soloveitchik Shurim. He was invited to give Shurim all over in different places. He gave Shurim Merkaz HaRav also, because he reminds him of the Netziv. I think Rav Soloveitchik would have been happier if he would have said he reminds him of Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, because the Netziv had a very different Derech Halima. Rav Soloveitchik's style was more similar to his grandfather's as opposed to the Netziv, who was the grandfather of Rav Chaim's wife. Rav Kook's first wife was the daughter of the Aderis. The Aderis is a Rashi Tevis, that's what people call them. Elio Dovi Rabinovich Ta'omim. The family name was Rabinowitz, but when he was born, Elio Dovi was born, he had a twin brother. Brother's name was Tzvi Yehuda. So Rav Kook's first wife was the daughter of this Aderis. The Aderis was appointed the rabbi in Panevich. Panevich was a prominent city. He was appointed the rabbi Panevich at the age of 31 or something like that. And that was a very big surprise. They never had such a young rabbi in such an important position. So he married, his first wife was the daughter of the Aderis. First, he was the rabbi in Panevich for a few years. And then he moved on. He was offered a position in Mir to be the Rosh Yeshiva. They wouldn't have the same person. In earlier years, the Rosh Yeshiva would be the same person as the rabbi in the community. And then somehow they adapted a position. They're not going to have the same person be the rabbi of the city and the Rosh Yeshiva. So they only appointed the Aderis as they invited him to come to be the Rosh Yeshiva in the Miri Yeshiva. It wasn't at all the style of learning that they have now. Now this style of learning is along the style of Rav Chaim Soloveitchik. And then that was the old style. So he left Panevich and he went to Mir. And then for many, many years, in the days of Rav Yosef Karo, who lived in Tzfat in Eretz on the 1550s, so all of the whole community was all Sephardim. They weren't the Ashkenazim. And then in the early 1800s, the Talmidim of the Baal Shem Tov, as well as Talmidim of the Vilna Gaon, moved to Eretz Yisrael, because they both encouraged the Baal Shem Tov and the Vilna Gaon encouraged the Talmidim to move to Eretz Yisrael. They felt that this would hasten the coming of Mashiach. So that's when Ashkenazim started to appear in Eretz Yisrael. So the Ashkenazim needed a Bezdin for Ashkenazim, because everybody there was Sephardim. So that's when they started the Badaks, the Bezdin Tzedek. And in the late 1800s, the head of the Badats was Reb Shmuel Salant, who was an old man. When he was about to reach the age of 80, so he encouraged the Ashkenazim, the community, that they should hire an assistant rabbi to take over when he'll have to retire. He's getting older. So there was a whole pilpul who should be appointed as the assistant rabbi. There are many different suggestions. I remember Rabbi Ram Shapiro, who used to be the chief rabbi of Eretz Yisrael for a while. He was the Rosh Yeshiva and Merkaz HaRav for quite a few years. So he told me that Rav Chaim Soloveitchik wanted that they should appoint Rav Bitzel Panevich as the assistant to Rav Shmuel Salant. Why? Because Rav Chaim felt that many Rabbanim would retire at an old age from Europe and they would move to Yerushalayim. They had many Rabbanim who were Meir Hara, who knew how to pass Kanshailas. But Rav Chaim felt that they need a big Talmid Chacham, a big Baal Mechadish. That's what's missing in Eretz Yisrael. So he felt that Rav Bitzel Panevich was the biggest Baal Mechadish of the generation. So he wanted that he should move to Eretz Yisrael. It didn't happen. So the one who was the community, Rav Shmuel Salant, sent a letter to Rav Chaim Oizer. The late 1800s, very late 1800s, almost 1900, something like 1898, when he was about to become 80 years old, and he asked Rav Chaim Oizer, can you please send someone here to become the assistant chief rabbi? So the Aderis happened to be traveling through Vilna at that time, and Rav Chaim Oizer spoke to him, and he agreed to go. So that's what happened. He moved to Eretz Yisrael. I think that was something like 1901. And he was appointed to take over when Rav Shmuel Salant will have to step down, will have to retire. What happened was that a few years later, 1905, he passed away. And Rav Shmuel Salant was still going strong. into his 90s, I think. He continued to be the head of the Eidei Haredes. So we were told that on the Matseva of the Aderes, who died in Yerushalayim, he's buried there. So it says, Shenisman Aliyos Rabbi Yerushalayim. He was appointed to take over the Rabbanis, but he never lived so long. He died while Rabbi Shmuel Salant was still alive, so he never took over the Rabbanis. But he was a famous Talmud Chacham. They quote a lot of psukim of his. Had a lot of chidushim. Take for example, there's a Mishnah Megillah that lechatchila it's not proper to blow shofar before Hanei Tzachama, even though after Alos HaShachar, strictly speaking, it has a din of Yom. But lechatchila we're afraid if you'll allow people to blow shofar, to shake a lulav, but to say halal before Hanei Tzachama, before sunrise. So the next thing you know, that people may make a mistake and say the halal and shake the lulav, say a bracha before Alos HaShachar, and that's the middle of the night, then they won't be yotze the mitzvah. So the Aderes had a suggestion that is manazed, that every other person wears a watch, and the people don't wear a watch, there's always a clock on the wall in the shul. So the whole gzeira doesn't apply bismanazed, because the whole reason for the gzeira is that the people may make a mistake and do the mitzvah before Alos HaShachar. The concern doesn't apply bismanazed. That's always a klal. Whenever you have a davar sheb'minyan, whenever the chachamim make gzeira derabbanan for a specific reason, even if you live in a generation when the whole reason doesn't apply, so the gzeira still applies. So how can he think to be mekel? It's very unclear. They don't explain why. It could be what he thought was the following: the Mishkan Asyankif has a tshuva, and not in a sefer Mishkan Asyankif in the latest sefer that put out. Kohelos Yankov has a lot on brachas and on Seder Moed, on the Gemara, and then he has a few tshuvas. So the first two tshuvas on Chelek HaShemishpot are very lomdisha tshuvas about this topic of Dovah Sheb'minyan. So he says, Dovah Sheb'minyan, Tzoch Mirach La'atiro, it's called the Tikkun Rabbanan Kein, the Raisa Tikkun. The din, on the level of the Raisa, whenever the Torah tells us a mitzvah, and we can figure out on our own what the reason for the mitzvah is. So should we say, Dashin and Taima Dikra, that the reason for the mitzvah, the Taima and Mitzvah, are the reasons for the mitzvah regulates the application of the mitzvah. So whenever the reason doesn't apply, the whole mitzvah doesn't apply. Or should you say, Lo Dashin and Taima Dikra, since the Torah doesn't write the reason. If the Torah writes the reason, so then whenever the reason doesn't apply, so the mitzvah doesn't apply. But if the Torah doesn't write the reason, we are on our own. We're guessing. We have all the Rabbanim get together and we give a suggestion. We decide what the reason is. So you have no right to say whenever the reason doesn't apply, the mitzvah doesn't apply. So that was a big machlokes in the days of the Tanaim. Reb Shimon Bar Yochai, Reb Shimon, the author of the Zohar, is the one who says, Dashin and Taima Dikra, that you can figure out on your own what the reason for the mitzvah is. Whenever the reason doesn't apply, the whole mitzvah doesn't apply. His opinion has not been accepted. We paskin only when the Chumash writes the mitzvah and gives the reason right next to the mitzvah, then you say, whenever the reason doesn't apply, the mitzvah doesn't apply. But whenever the Chumash doesn't write the reason, then it doesn't apply. So that's what the Mishkan and Sanke writes in his tshuva. All the takanas derabbanan were patterned after the dinim deraisa. So Ruba de Ruba, 98% of the Takanas de Rabbanan, they always had good reasons to make a din de Rabbanan, but they wouldn't publicize the reason. They wouldn't incorporate the Tamak Zera into the Zera. If you're going to publicize the reason, you're going to say, not allowed to do this because of this concern. So every Tom, Dick, and Harry will say, I'm not an idiot. I know what's mut, I know what's osa. I'm an intelligent person. So I'm going to be careful not to violate any dinim. So no one will observe the Zera's de Rabbanan. So the Gemara says, whenever they used to make a gzera derabanan, they wouldn't let anybody know the reason for 12 months. After everyone would be observing the gzera derabanan, then they would tell them what the reason is. And the Gemara even tells a story in Maseches Avodah Zarah that one of the Tanan was invited to attend the meeting when they were going to discuss whether they should prohibit gvina sakum, cheese that's processed by non-Jews. And he wasn't able to attend. Then the next day he asked, oh, you had the meeting and you asked Gvina Sakum, why did you ask it? So he said, sorry, you weren't there at the meeting. We can't tell you the reason. He was invited to come to the meeting, but because it wasn't there, so they said, we can't tell you the reason. And because the reason for the Xeri was never incorporated as part of the Gzeira. So that's why years later it was forgotten. What is the real reason? So the Gemara gives around seven different suggestions. Why did they prohibit the Gvina Sakum? And it's a machlekes halacha lemaisa. What is the real reason? Why is Gvina Sakum asa? So the Mishkan is Yankiv there develops a whole idea. So he says, whenever the Gzeira de Rabbanon is Bakiras Dovim and Atayra, whenever, let's say, they made Gzeira de Rabbanon, that when Rosh Hashanah falls out on Shabbos, you're not allowed to blow shofar. That's against what it says in the Torah. So they can't. And the Torah says you have to blow shofar on Rosh Hashanah. It doesn't make a difference whether Rosh Hashanah falls out on Shabbos around a week. That blowing shofar is not a malacha. It's a tkir shofar is a chachma, vein a malacha. It's not a malacha. So if they wanted to prohibit blowing shofar on Rosh Hashanah, they had to incorporate the reason for the gzera into the gzera. Otherwise, the gzera, they're just going to make a din stoma. So it contradicts the din in the Chumash. How can the Gzeira de Rabbanon blend in to be part of the Torah Shmal Peh if it's in contradiction to what it says in the Torah that you're supposed to blow shofar from Rosh Hashanah? Or they made Gzeira de Rabbanon that if you're wearing a beged shel pishtan, you're not permitted to put in tzitzis. Gzeira, the din is like Bishamai. You're not permitted. This is against what it says in the Chumash. Chumash says a beged shel pishtan, you are obligated to put in tzitzis. So when they made that Gzeira de Rabbanim, whenever the nature of the Gzeira is Keneged Adin in the Torah, Akira's Dabman HaTorah B'Shev Al-Tasa, so that's the theme of the Mishkan HaSiyang. Then they had to incorporate the Tamak Gzeira into the Nusach HaGzeira. Then he says, whenever the Tamak Gzeira is incorporated into the Nusach HaGzeira, then it can't be, then whenever you live in a generation where the reason doesn't apply, then the whole Gzeira doesn't apply. All you have to do is Paskin. The Bezin doesn't have to be oiker, the Takana, the Rabban, just have to Paskin. The reason doesn't apply. So Mimela, the whole din doesn't apply. So that's perhaps what the Aderis was thinking of, that really the din should have been, as Riz Magdim and the Mitzvahs, more correct on the level of the Raisa is, that if you can shake the Lulam, you can blow Shofar, and you can say Halal before Hanetzacham, after Los HaShachar, the Chatchilat should be a Mitzvah Bishlei Musa, to do it as early as possible. So when the Chachamim prohibited doing all the mitzvahs, doing a bris milah before Hanetzachama and saying halal and shaking the lula before Hanetzachama and blowing shofar, so that was really Akira Dovman HaTorah. They're telling you to violate the din of Ziz Magdim and mitzvahs. So then they had to incorporate the Tamak Zer into the Nusach Hagzer. So if you live in a generation where every other person has a watch and whoever doesn't have a watch can look at the clock on the wall, so since the reason for the Gzera doesn't apply, so the whole Gzera perhaps should fall apart. That was the argument of the Aderis. But at that time, when he lived in Eretz Yisrael, the 4 or 5 years that he lived there, he came to Eretz Yisrael in 1901, between 1901 and 1905 when he passed away, there were other Gedolim there, so his opinion was outvoted. They all said it's not correct. Even though every other person has a watch and every shul has a clock on the wall, they didn't think that they should change the din in the Mishnah. The Gedolim who were there at that time, they all outvoted him. It's interesting, he wrote many Sfarim, but during his lifetime, I don't think he printed anything he couldn't afford. It was expensive. So after the Aderis passed away, so his daughter had predeceased him. His daughter was married to Rav Kook. That was Rav Kook's first wife. And after she had one daughter with Rav Kook, and after she passed away, then the Aderis encouraged Rav Kook to remarry and to remarry his niece, the daughter of his twin brother. His twin brother's name was Tzvi Yehuda. So that's why they had a boy later on, Tzvi Yehuda Kook, the son of Rav Kook. It was named after the grandfather, after the second father-in-law of Rav Kook. After the Aderis passed away, his daughter had already died before him, and he had a son. The son was not into learning at all. So the son didn't know what to do with all the Svarim. The father wrote so many Kisva Yad. They say that he wrote over 100 Svarim. He was writing many Svarim at the same time. He was writing commentaries on the Sefer Achinuch. So whenever he had a Chiddush to write, he wrote it down. The Sefer kept on getting bigger and bigger. And then he wrote, he had one Sefer. Big Rabbanim would often visit by him when he was in Ponevish and when he was in Nir. So Rab Chaim Soloveitchik and many other, Yosameach, all the Gedolim would visit by him. So he would engage them in conversation, talking and learning. So he had one separate Sefer. He would write what I heard from this one, what I heard from that one, separate sefer for the chidushim of the guests. And then he wrote many svarim at the same time. So after he died, had cartons full of all of the svarim. So when he passed away, his son didn't know what to do with the svarim. So because his father had originally been the rabbi in Panovich, so the son gave away all the cartons of the Kisviyad to the Panovich yeshiva, that they should do something with it. Panovich yeshiva was embarrassed to have anything to do with Rabbi Cook, because he was with the Rabbanut, and they didn't care for the Rabbanut. So they had all these Kisviyad rotting away in the library. So right next door to the Merkaz Harav, there's a yeshiva for the high school students, Yeshiva Latzirim. In Eretz Yisrael, they call it Yashlatz, the Rosh Hashem, the Yeshiva Latzirim. So one of the rabbis in the high school once said, half jokingly, half seriously, maybe it would be an idea that some of the boys should go to Bnei Brak, to the Panovich Yeshiva, and take all of the cartons of Kisviyad, and we're going to print them. So some of the boys went, and they walked off with the cartons from the library. They were not under lock and key. At that time, Rav Shach was a young man who was only about 90 years old. So he said, Kazlanim, they should give back immediately. They have to give back all of this swarm that they stole. It belongs to the yeshiva. Yeshiva didn't plan to do anything with them. They were sitting and rotting away. So the boys made a Xerox copy of every page, and then they put it back the same place where they took it. Just like when they took it, nobody realized. And when they put it back, nobody realized. So from that time on, every 2-3 years, another sefer comes out from one yeshiva or another, from all of those who are in orbit of Merkaz Harav. I don't think Merkaz Harav ever put out, but other yeshivas put out. So one of the svarim that they put out, I think it's called Pnei David, the Deris writes that some people leave a big Yerusha of money for their children. He was never too wealthy. He doesn't have any money to leave for the children. He's going to leave a Yerusha of Midas Chasidus. So he writes all of his Midas Chasidus. Unfortunately, the daughter who was married to Rav Kook predeceased him. She died in Europe. She died already before Rav Kook went there to Israel. And then he married her cousin. And then his son was not bar hochi to have anything. So that's one of the first svarim that they printed, the sefer of his Midas Chasidus. He writes very interesting things. He writes when he was in Europe, many of the people didn't have a yarmulke. The men didn't have a yarmulke, so they wear a hat all day long. So when they would daven shachris, they would put the tefillin on with the hat on top. And he holds that that's not right. Just like it says in the Gemara, when you have tefillin on your head, you shouldn't carry a bundle of package on your head, because the tefillin's going to get pushed out of the right place. So we're going to wear a hat also. The tefillin's going to be in the wrong location. So he felt that that's not right. More correct is you should not wear a hat. You should wear a yarmulke. So he used to distribute yarmulkes free of charge. He used to give whenever he saw a person who was wearing a hat with a tefillin. He said, next time you daven, here's a yarmulke, put on a yarmulke. Today in the yeshivas, they feel as if that's the way to go. You have to wear a hat when you wear the tefillin. And the hat really gets in the way. It's very hard to have the tefillin in the right place and the hat on at the same time. So he was a big paisik. The Adaris was known as a big paisik. And he felt that that's not correct. He has. He writes also in his not sefer Pnei David. He writes also that we paskin in Shulchan Aruch that the mitzvah of mezuzah only applies when Torah if the house belongs to you. If it's a rented house, it's only chiyuv mezuzah med the rabbanim shem arisayin. People may think that the house belongs to you because the pasuk says saptam al mezuzah beisecha bisharecha. The chaf means if the house belongs to you. So he says he can never afford to buy a house, so he never had a mezuzah deraisa. So he wanted to convert his rented apartment to make a chiyuv mezuzah min haTorah. So he came up with an ein fal. So just like on the first 2 days of Sukkot, in each Shalachem, by the Dalaminim, so not everybody could afford to pay for their own Dalaminim. A lot of people ask for Matal Manas Lahachzir. So he used to, every month, when he would pay in advance for the rent of the apartment, he would tell the landlord, I don't want to rent the apartment. I want to buy the apartment on Maton Manas Lahachzer. I want to own the apartment and on the condition that I'll give it back to you at the end of the month. So every month he would buy the apartment Maton Manas Lahachzer. So the Chiyuv Mezuzah would be their eyes. This is what he mentions. He's encouraging his children, his descendants, they should do this Midas Chasidus as well. Or they quote that this is not in his sefer, they quote in his name. In other Svarim, they quote that The meaning is that we, like on Tisha B'Av, on a Tanis Tzibu, when they lay in Baichal, so everybody says along, Hashem Hashem Kalarach Manchan Lot Abalkuri. And the same thing when you get to the end of Eicha, you say Hashemena Hashem Elech Manushuach Hashemena Kikedem. So there's a meaning that on Purim there are four different psukim in the Megillah, psukim of Yeshua, that Ahirim Hasar V'Simcha V'Sasim Yikar, and so on. So there's a big meaning that the various psukim in Torah, Nevi'im, Aksuvim, you say along with the Balkarei, the psukim that speak about Nechama and Yeshua and Slicha and Kapar and so on, one big meaning. So the question is, you should read the whole Megillah Mitoch HaKesav. But Yeved, if you read 51% Mitoch HaKesav, 49% Baal Peh, you're Yotze B'Yeved, but L'chatchil, you should hear the whole Megillah Mitoch HaKesav. So the earlier Psukim, everybody says it before the Baal Kori says it, then the Baal Kori lanes it. So we didn't finish the Mikra Megillah yet. So even though we said that Pasuk Baal Peh, but we weren't Yotze the Mitzvah yet, we didn't finish the whole Mikra Megillah. So the Baal Kori reads the Mitoch HaKesav, so it comes out that everything is Mitoch HaKesav. But the meaning is he said the last Pasuk before the Baal Kori. So once you say the very last Pasuk, then you Yotze the whole Mitzvah Mikra Megillah only on a level of B'dievet, because you didn't lay in everything the last Pasuk you said Baal Peh. You didn't say Mitoch HaKesav, unless you have your own Megillah in front of you. But if you have a printed Chumash in front of you, then you yotze a b'dievet. So the Aderis had a suggestion when it comes to the last pasuk, you shouldn't say it before the Baal Kori. Let the Baal Kori say the pasuk first, and then you say it afterwards. Because till he's going to roll up the Megillah to say the bracha, Rabbis Riveni after, it's going to take time anyway. So he recommends you shouldn't say the last pasuk before, you should rather say the last pasuk after. All that was a practice. All the Gdolim in Europe, many of them used to have Hoyroes. It came out on every page in Shulchan Aruch. They had a twist of a Hoyroah, how to do this, how to do that. So the Aderis was a famous Pesach. And that was the first father-in-law of Rav Kook. He moved to Eretz Yisrael in 1901, and then he passed away in 1905, and Rav Kook moved to Eretz Yisrael in 1904. So after the Aderis passed away, so Rav Kook put out a sefer in his honor, describing what a great goyin he was. That's called Ha'eder Hayakar, his beloved Aderis, and he writes very beautiful things about his father-in-law. Anyway, these were two goyinim adirim. Aderis was a famous goyin. They asked the Mishnah, is it permissible to have zecher lahakel? There's a din in the Chumash. Every 7 years, this Chol HaMoed Sukkah is following Shnas HaShmita. When everybody comes to Be'er LeRegel, it says in the Chumash, we have a Kriyas HaTorah once every 7 years, a Kriyas HaTorah, the Reis of Tzibur. Everybody should gather together. And the practice is that the Melech would lane Parshas Hakel. That's probably not Mi'akeh B'dievet. We assume that B'zman has said there's no din of Hakel Mi'ikra din, because the whole Shmita is only B'dirabbanah. There is no Shemitah Deraisa today, so it's not really the Sukkah following Shnas HaShmita. But in Eretz Yisrael, for many years already, they have a Zecher LaHakel, that they have when Rabbi Herzog's son was the president of the Medina, so he used to lay in Parshas Hakel. Then other years, they had someone else from the government would lay in the Parshas Hakel. By the Kaisel HaMaravi, it's very, very beautiful. So the question is it permissible to do an imitation mitzvah? So the Aderis wrote a whole essay, a whole sefer, a small sefer, called Zecher LaHakel, where he says the rule in the Gemara is, this is the issue for the women's prayer groups, is it permissible to have an imitation mitzvah, an imitation women's minion? So the Gemara, that's what the Aderis points out, the Gemara says the klal is, if there's a concern that Dilma Nafik Menei Churva, then we don't allow you to do an imitation mitzvah. Let's say you don't have a kosher esrog 1 year. So can you use a lemon? And we won't say a bracha. Or you don't have a kosher shofar. You have only a posel shofar. Are you permitted to blow shofar without a bracha? A zecher shofar. A zecher esrog. So the Gemara says, we're concerned. If this year we'll use a lemon, so next year people may forget that we didn't say a bracha. They'll not think you can use a lemon. Last year we remember we used a lemon. Next year they may say a bracha on it. That'll be a bracha about Toma. Or they may use the pasul of shofar next year and they'll say a bracha on it. Whenever there's a concern, then you're not allowed to. So the Adera says that when he came to Eretz Yisrael, he asked them, alamdim, those who taught the little children, chumash, and he asked them, what do they do when it comes Shnas HaShmita, the year Sukkot following Shnas HaShmita? They said that was the practice for many years before he came to Eretz Yisrael. They would bring the children to the Kosel HaMarovi and Chol HaMoed Sukkot following Shnas HaShmita, and they would learn the parshas from a printed chumash. They would make a zecher lahakel, and they never heard that any avera came out from it. It was never nafik b'nei churva. So that's what the Adaras writes. That's the klal in the Gemara. Whenever there's no concern of dilma nafik b'nei churva, then it's permissible to make a zecher lahakel, to do an imitation mitzvah. Gemara has a machlokes hatanam. Is it permissible to allow women to do an imitation smicha on the korbanos? The mitzvah of smicha, to lean on the animal, b'chol koch, only applies to men who bring a korban. The women don't have the mitzvah, so the women are not permitted. It would be an isur of mishtamesh b'kotchim, be an isur of avasavi b'chol sherecha, be an isur of avoida b'kotchim, if they're going to lean on the korban b'chol koichim. So there was a machlokes hatanaim in the days of the second Beis Hamikdash, would we permit the women to make an imitation smicha just to have their hands float on top of the korban? That's the girsa that we have in the Gemara. The Miri had a different girsa. The Rabbi had a different girsa in Provence. But the way it says in our Gemara, it was only an imitation smicha. So that was a machlokes hatanaim. Do you make gzera dilma nafik b'nei churva? So that's famous. The Netziv, the Aderis, wrote such an essay, and he felt that there's no concern. So they have a collection. After the Chazon Ish passed away, they published first one volume, then a second, then a third, little volumes of collection of letters of the Chazon Ish. Beautifully, he had his own style of Hebrew, like Chaim Soloveitchik has a totally unique style of Hebrew. So the Chazon Ish also had his own different style of Hebrew, very beautiful. Even if you're not happy about what he writes every so often, things against the Zionist movement, but he writes in such a beautiful poetic style, so he can't be angry about what he writes. So they have in the collection of letters, they have one thing that's not a letter, that they had a copy of this sefer by the Aderis that's called Zecher LeHakel, and the Chazon Ish wrote, it's a paperback sefer, very small kuntres. The Chazon Ish wrote on the cover of the book, Ein lismach al ma shekosa b'sefer hazeh. Shouldn't rely on what it says in the sefer. So that's why every 7 years, when they have the Zecher LeHakel by the Kosel HaMarabi, so the Bnei Yeshiva never go. But the people who did go say that it's beautiful. They say it's so impressive that people dressed up like Leviim and blowing chatzotzeres, and it's so very, very impressive. Anyway, so these were two gedolim who really didn't get their proper covered in history. Rav Kook was considered a great goyim and a great tzaddik. All the gedolim of the generation, they had such respect for him. They had a couple of kanoim who gave him a hard time, a couple of kanoim in Europe and a couple of kanoim in Yerushalayim, but there were always a couple of lunatics. And the Aderis also was a great goyim. His first father-in-law was a great goyim. They were never really given the cover that they deserved. Everyone should have a pleasant week. Should all be healthy. Be well.